You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Live from Chicken Town, this is the Flopcast, episode 481.
On flopcast.net.
Kevin and Cornflake like to have coffee and cartoons, and so they turned on their microphone and made a Flopcast just for you, might be. Sorry, they'll still turn your sad frown upside down. Coming at you live from Chicken Town.
Yes, yes, hello, Cornflake.
Well, hey, how are you, Kevin?
I'm fine. I went to Woonsocket today. Woonsocket, Rhode Island.
How was Woonsocket, Kevin?
So how could that not be a great day? I seriously spent several hours in Woonsocket this morning. It was bizarre.
You know how to make the most of a day, Kevin.
It had to be done, but I slipped back over the border out of Rhode Island. I'm safely back up here in Massachusetts now. It is episode 481. That means we're talking 1981 today in chapter 2 of our 10-part series celebrating the 80s. First, however, Cornflake, what are we doing for National Whatever Day?
National Whatever Day!
Kevin, how about for this week's National Whatever Day, we celebrate the milestone birthday of somebody who was born in 1981?
Oh, perfect. If I'm doing the math correctly, somebody's turning 40 this week?
Yeah, and it probably not a name that you recognize. This is Eric Lively.
I have no idea who that is.
He had a bit role in the movie American Pie back in 1999.
Okay.
He played a preppy guy named Albert. He was also in The L Word.
Yep.
Do you remember the television show The L Word?
I remember that it existed. I never saw it. I saw American Pie, the movie, once.
Once was enough for me.
Sure. So why do we care about this guy?
Because he was Stephanie Tanner's first boyfriend on Full House.
Oh, okay. So why do you care about this guy? And
right?
Why do I continue to not care about this guy? Got it.
And beyond that, in more recent times, and by more recent, I mean 2009, he was in one of Pink's music videos for the song Please Don't Leave Me.
Yeah, I remember her.
She's still around. There was a documentary about her recently.
I saw a video of her. She was at some award show and she was like hanging from a rope, dancing around. It was her and her daughter.
Yeah, Jameson.
Did you see that?
That's something that she does with some of her live shows as well. She's got some serious acrobatics.
Yeah, it's like those dancers that they have at those burlesque shows that we used to go to. Like,
yeah.
They haul them up into the air on a rope and they spin around. Yeah, Pink does that.
Aerial trapeze type stuff.
Yeah, with her little daughter.
Yeah, it's pretty great. I wish I could be Pink's daughter. I would have the best time with that. Probably my life would be very different, too.
So does this kid, Eric, what's his name? Does he spin around in the air like Pink in the video?
No. So I know this because I also know that he didn't do his own stunts in that video. There was a stuntman for him.
Yeah, it's all a lie. I don't think he's even really 40 years old this week. He's having the stunt guy celebrate his birthday on his behalf.
Man, I wish I could have a stunt guy celebrate my birthdays for me. Why aren't we doing that? That's actually an amazing idea.
Why bother having a birthday? Just farm it out. Just hire somebody.
Hire someone to have your birthday for you.
That's the move.
Kevin, you come up with some really great ideas.
Oh, yeah. All my ideas are really good. My ideas make perfect sense.
So happy birthday, Eric Lively.
Yeah, sure, I guess. Now we can move right along to the main topic for today's show. So it's episode 481. We are looking at the year 1981. And I thought we've been doing so much music talk lately that I thought we'd shift completely over to TV of 1981. Because I think as we mentioned last week, last year, the mayor and I did a couple of episodes of the Flopcast in your absence, just looking at all the new TV shows of 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, let's do that today for 1981.
I like that idea.
So I've got a list here. I have all the new primetime network shows that debuted in the year 1981. We have them all here.
Excellent.
And a bunch of these we can blaze through really quick because who cares? Such as, like, you don't care about Dynasty, do you?
My family did.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a big deal with my family.
I mean, it was a huge hit show. Everybody watched Dynasty. I did not.
Nor did, well, I didn't understand it. I sometimes snuck downstairs to try to see what my family was all watching when they had it on at night, but it didn't make sense to me.
I've never seen a second of Dynasty, but this was like primetime soap opera was big,
right?
Like Dallas, and that was a huge hit. Then they did Dynasty, also a huge hit. And also in 81, there was Dynasty, and then there was also Falcon Crest.
Falcon Crest, yes!
Yet another one. Again, I know nothing about it. I still don't. But then there were tons of like police and detective shows. That was a big thing this year.
Such as?
Such as, well, a couple of them were hits and stuck around for a while, such as Hill Street Blues. And that was a strange new twist on a way to make television, because the thinking was, well, movies are good, TV is stupid. And that's just the way Hollywood operated. Is, oh, this could be stupid. It's a TV show. Just go make a stupid show. People will watch it. There's three networks. We can throw garbage on the air. Everybody will watch. And they were correct.
Yes, spot on.
This was, you know, Stephen Bochco came up with Hill Street Blues, and he's like, what if we made it good? That was this crazy concept back then. But then going back to the goofy category, there was stuff like Simon and Simon was a big hit. And I think that was, it was two brothers and their detectives.
Oh, is that what that was?
Yeah, I believe. And I know one of them was Gerald McRaney, who then he was Major Dad. Remember the
Major
sitcom?
Dad.
Yeah, that guy. He was one of the Simons. He was Simon and Simon. This concludes everything I know about Simon and Simon. Thank you.
Which is more than I knew about Simon and Simon. So thank you.
Now you're an expert like me. And then I believe we've talked about this show a couple of times. The Fall Guy.
Yes, we have talked about The Fall Guy.
Because this was Lee Majors, who I knew as the $6 million man. Now he's a stuntman.
Yeah, I did not see it until it was in syndication, but I did see it.
Yeah, I think you've seen more Fall Guy than me. You must have, because I've seen none.
Yes.
But you taught me just a few months ago, you informed me that Marky Post from Night Court was a regular on Fall Guy.
Yes, he was.
And I was shocked.
You had no idea about this.
I was just rattled like I had never been before. Those were the hit action-adventure drama shows that started in 1981. Now, here's a lightning round of shows that came and went really quickly and nobody even remembers them. Nero Wolfe was a detective series that was based on, you know, Nero Wolfe was a famous detective character from books in like the early 20th century, I think. And this was a series, TV series, starring William Conrad. Who cares? There's a show called Walking Tall. This was a sheriff in Tennessee. They made 7 episodes, Walking Tall.
7 too many.
Yeah, it was way too many. Yeah. There's a show called The Gangster Chronicles. And it was, you know, based on real life gangsters of the past, including Bugsy Siegel and guys like that. They made a drama series, The Gangster Chronicles. And I made a note of it because a couple of the stars of the show included Jonathan Banks, who people know these days from Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. I knew him from Otherworld back in the mid-80s, but Jonathan Banks was on the show. And another regular on this, evidently, was Marky Post.
What do you know?
She was in everything. There's a show called Today's FBI. And this was like an updated version of that. Back in the 60s, there was a show just called FBI. Then in 81, they brought it back. They called it Today's FBI. It was stories based on real FBI cases.
Now that sounds like it has some potential.
Yeah, but evidently it did not. Oh. There was a show called Shannon. It's a New York City detective. He's a single father. And he relocates to San Francisco.
Oh.
There you go.
Captivating television from you the know? Sounds of it.
There's a show called Strike Force. This was an Aaron Spelling production. Strike Force. Robert Stack, who people knew back in the 60s, he was the star of The Untouchables. This was Robert Stack, and he's a detective. It's another detective show. And evidently it was considered very violent for its time. There was a show called McLean's Law. And once again, this was James Arness, who was on Gunsmoke. He's an old detective who comes out of retirement. And this show also was considered very violent for its time, McLean's Law. And I got one more, which is also like a remake or a sequel to an old show from the 50s and 60s, Brett Maverick. Because there was a show called Maverick back in the day that was James Garner.
Right.
James Garner, who was, for the Rockford Files in the 70s. They tried to bring Maverick back, but this time they called it by his full name, Brett Maverick. Did not last long at all. There's your lightning round of detective shows and whatnot that nobody remembers. Here's something that I do vaguely remember. There was a show called Father Murphy.
I also vaguely remember Father Murphy.
It seemed like a spinoff from Little House on the Prairie, although it wasn't. But it practically was, because it was produced by Michael Landon from Little House on the Prairie. It was set in the same time period. This was like the 1870s, and Father Murphy was played by Merlin Olsen. And Merlin Olsen was a regular on Little House on the Prairie, but playing a different character. But in Father Murphy, he was just a guy, but then he takes in a bunch of orphans. Like, he rescues a bunch of orphans because they were going to be put to work, like in a workhouse. And in order to take them in, he disguises himself as a priest. That's the wacky premise.
Oh.
Doesn't that sound creepy and bizarre that it's a guy? Like, to our modern sensibilities.
Yeah.
How do you sell that show? That it's a guy disguising himself as a priest and taking in a bunch of children. That sets off all kinds of alarms. But... this was on the level. This was a good guy rescuing orphans by posing as a priest.
Yeah, you couldn't make a show like that these days.
That would not work today. Here's one that I don't think I ever saw, but of interest to us. A show called Code Red, produced by Irwin Allen, who was the guy that produced like Lost in Space and Land of the Giants and all that stuff back in the 60s. And then he made all the disaster movies in the 70s. This was the final Irwin Allen TV series about firefighters, like a family of firefighters, but interesting cast. The father of this family was Lorne Greene from Bonanza back in the day. And then at this point, he would have been coming right off of Battlestar Galactica. And then one of his sons was Sam Jones, coming right off of Flash Gordon.
Oh.
Yeah, so he's one of the firemen. And Lorne Greene's wife on the show was Julie Adams. She was the woman, the star of Creature from the Black Lagoon back in the 50s.
Right.
And also the young son on the show was Adam Rich, who was the kid on Eight is Enough.
Oh.
So young Adam Rich is creeping around the firehouse. What a cast.
I think I'd have watched that. That sounds cool.
And then I like this part. It says that some episodes would end with a member of the cast lecturing the audience about fire safety.
Oh, that sounds so 80s.
I mean, it sounds like a Filmation cartoon. You know, that's how like He-Man would end, or that's how the Shazam ended. You get a little moral lecture to the audience.
And there were all those PSAs as well.
Yeah, this was a primetime show that would end with the cast delivering a PSA about first aid and fire safety.
Wow.
I like that. I'd like to see that. I want to see like Sam Jones and Adam Rich lecturing me about fire safety.
Yeah, that needs a resurgence.
I want a PSA about firefighting from Flash Gordon. Here's a show that I remember. I'd forgotten all about it, and then it came crashing back to me as I was reading up on this stuff. There was a show called Dark Room, and this was like a horror thriller anthology series. There'd be two or three different like little stories each week. So sort of Twilight Zone format, you know, like a different little self-contained story. And all kinds of people pop up in these shows because there's a whole different cast for every story. So Helen Hunt is in one of them, very young Helen Hunt. Billy Crystal is in one. June Lockhart from Lost in Space. Rue McClanahan did one.
Oh, from Golden Girls.
Future Golden Girl, Rue McClanahan. Michael Lembeck did one, you know, from Captain Cool and the Kongs and One Day at a Time, favorite of ours. But I remember watching this show, and I remember the beginning of the show because it had a super creepy, scary opening in which, like, the camera kind of pans through a building or a house or something while this creepy voice narrates about the dark room. And then you end in a dark room, like where you develop film.
Oh yeah. It's a creepy looking room.
Yeah. You see like a red light bulb, like hanging, swinging back and forth. And it's scary and weird.
Yeah. I've been in a room like that.
Most of these horror anthology shows of the 80s, and there were a bunch of them. Most of them, the scariest part is just the opening sequence. That's usually the best part of the show. And then the actual story would be kind of lame, but like Tales from the Dark Side had this wonderful, creepy opening. And a lot of those shows had a great opening and then a disappointing story. Now let's get into some comedies and other miscellaneous oddities. There was a sitcom called Harper Valley PTA.
There was a song about that, I remember.
Yeah, well, that's the weird thing is it started as a song, country song.
A very sassy country song.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know the song, right?
I do.
It's a woman in this small town.
She's sick of this PTA people wagging their tongues.
Yeah, well, they kind of are gossiping or they're accusing her of being immoral and unfit for their pure, wonderful little small town. And then she just kind of calls everybody out on how they're all at least as horrible as she is. Everybody on the PTA. But yeah, it was just a goofy country song from like the late 60s, I guess. And then they made a movie of it in the 70s. There was a Harper Valley PTA movie starring Barbara Eden from I Dream of Jeannie. Then here's the TV show, the sitcom, Harper Valley PTA, also starring Barbara Eden. I remember that this happened, but I never watched this show. I can't imagine it was any good, but who knows? But there it is.
Even with Barbara Eden in it, I don't know that I would have been sold.
Yeah, that's a tough sell. I like how they would just make movies and TV shows out of songs, though, because that happened more than once in this era. That happened to like several Kenny Rogers songs. They would turn into movies. You could take a country song and just make a movie out of it back then. We should bring that back.
I don't think so.
Here's one, though, that's very important to us, Cornflake. And this is one that I know we've spoken of in previous Flopcast episodes where we focused on 1981, The Brady Brides.
That was 1981.
Yeah. So Brady Brides, they made a movie. They made a TV movie called The Brady Girls Get Married, in which Marcia and Jan have a double wedding. And then that led to the series, The Brady Brides. So now it's Jan and Marcia and their husbands, and they buy a house together. And it's like a clash of Marcia's husband is like the free spirit, easygoing dude. And Jan's husband is a like uptight, straight-laced guy. And thus the comedy.
Oh, of the clashing of them.
Yeah. It was a huge hit. It lasted 7 weeks.
Oh.
But, you know, we love it. The Brady Brides. Another sitcom that was a movie first was Private Benjamin. This was the Goldie Hawn movie. It was like rich, spoiled girl joins the army.
Yeah, I needed the reminder. Now I remember.
It was Goldie Hawn in the movie. She's Private Benjamin.
Right.
And then they made the sitcom version, which lasted a couple of years, I think. And not with Goldie Hawn, of course. She was a movie star. She wasn't going to make the sitcom.
Right.
So they had to get a new Private Benjamin. And a couple of the supporting cast from the movie did show up for the sitcom as well, because Eileen Brennan was there and Hal Williams. You would know him as the husband on 227, Marla Gibbs' husband. And then they had Robert Mandan from Soap, Lucy Webb, who I remember from Not Necessarily the News. Wendy Jo Sperber was in there from Bosom Buddies. So a pretty strong cast. And I watched a little bit of Private Benjamin. I don't think I ever saw the movie.
I never saw the movie, and I don't think I saw Private Benjamin in 1981, but I did in the years that it was still on.
Yeah, it was around for a couple of years, I think.
Yeah.
There might have even been some reruns at some point, so you might have stumbled upon some Private Benjamin. Maybe we should check out the movie sometime. Maybe we'd love it.
That could be a Flopcast movie.
Perhaps.
Yeah. Night.
We'll get together and watch Private Benjamin, but I somehow doubt it. Speaking of Marla Gibbs from 227, originally we knew her as Florence, the maid on the Jeffersons, of course. And there was a spinoff. She got her own spinoff from the Jeffersons called Checking in which she was the head of housekeeping at a hotel.
Oh.
Larry Linville, who was Major Burns on MASH, he was also part of the hotel staff. And weirdly, Ruth Brown was on this show, as in R&B legend, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee Ruth Brown. She also did some acting, and she was a regular on Checking In.
Nice.
Now, Marla Gibbs, I learned this from Ken Reed over on TV Guidance Counselor. When Marla Gibbs was going to leave the Jeffersons to do this spinoff, she worked it into her contract that if Checking In was not successful, if it didn't last long, she would be able to return to the Jeffersons.
Smart.
Yeah, super smart lady. And guess what? Checking in lasted 4 episodes. And Marla got to go back to, you know, the big hit show, The Jeffersons. So it was like there was hardly even any time to miss her, you know?
Right.
She was away for like a weekend, essentially. And then, okay, Florence is back. Here's one that I watched back then, Cornflake. Goofy sitcom called Best of the West. I don't remember if we've ever talked about this on the Flapcast. I feel like we must have. But Best of the West was like a Western, like the Old West sitcom. But this starred Joel Higgins, who would go on to be Ricky Schroeder's father on Silver Spoons. That guy.
Oh, him. Yeah.
Yeah. He's the star of Best of the West. And his son on Best of the West, not Ricky Schroeder, but Mino Peluse, who was on the Bad News Bears TV series as Tanner. And after this, he was the star of Voyagers, the time-traveling show. He was on everything back then. Crazy, goofy, catchy theme song, which I remember all too well to this day. I would watch Best of the West, just a goofy Western sitcom.
That does sound goofy.
Here's one that was not a sitcom, but sort of a fantasy adventure kind of series, I guess. A show called Mr. Merlin.
Mr. Merlin as in the wizard?
Yeah, as in Merlin the wizard. But it's just set in modern day regular times. And the concept is that Merlin has just been alive for thousands of years. And he's living just in the normal world today, disguised as a mechanic.
Man, do I wish I could have a wizard for a mechanic.
Then he takes in this young apprentice who is going to be, you know, learning about how to be a magician and whatnot. And the kid that he takes in was played by Clark Brandon, who would be recognizable to us as, from the Facts of Life, he was Joe's boyfriend. Remember Joe had that boyfriend who was in the Navy?
Yes.
They ran off to elope together in one very exciting episode. Mm-hmm. That kid, he was the co-star on Mr. Merlin. I know the mayor of Chickentown, Felicity, was a big fan of Mr. Merlin. Here's a weird one.
Okay.
Which I don't remember, but there was a show called Fitz and Bones, and it's described as a comedy slash drama. I guess they were going for everything here. Fitz and Bones. One of them, Fitz, I guess, was a San Francisco news reporter, and Bones was his inept cameraman. So Fitz and Bones, they're running around San Francisco, I guess, having adventures and whatnot, getting into all sorts of mix-ups and trouble. And here's the wacky part, though. They were played by the Smothers Brothers.
Oh, love it.
So, yikes. I completely missed Fitz and Bones.
I don't remember ever even hearing about this before.
Yeah, me either.
And I was a Smothers Brothers fan.
Oh, sure you were.
I think I would love to see that if it's available somewhere.
This might be your favorite new show.
It's possible.
Here's one that I remember all too well. You know the theme song. It's Love, Sydney.
Yes.
This was Swoozy Kurtz was the woman, and she had a little daughter played by Kalina Kiff, and they move in with their friend played by Tony Randall.
Nice.
And it's got that adorable theme song where it's the three of them, the cast, even the little girl, they sing the Love, Sydney theme song. And then a few decades later, me and the great Luke Ski also performed the Love, Sydney theme song at MarsCon.
I'll never forget.
That's how much it means to us. This started as a TV movie. And in the movie, it was more obvious that Tony Randall's character, Sydney, was gay.
Oh.
And then they toned it way down for the TV series. Like, it was so subtle that it didn't even matter. You couldn't even tell.
It was no longer evident.
So I guess they kind of chickened out, you know, at the network. And here's one that you and I were both big fans of, I believe. Also, Cornflake, Give Me a Break.
Yes, with Nell Carter.
Of course. We love Nell Carter. And we were just talking about Give Me a Break like a couple of weeks ago.
We were, yeah.
Because of the sweet list. We did a top 4.5 list of sweet things.
With Dolph Sweet.
Gruff but lovable Chief Kaniski on Give Me a Break, played by gruff but lovable actor Dolph Sweet. Nell Carter is the housekeeper. And then he's the single dad with the three daughters. And then eventually they brought in Joey Lawrence.
Right.
And then eventually they brought in other Joey Lawrence, like an even younger Lawrence brother. They just kept bringing in more Lawrence brothers. Like Russian dolls of nesting Lawrence brothers on Give Me a Break as it just went on and on and on. Here's one that I have zero memory of at all. But again, this is interesting. There's a sitcom called Lewis and Clark. So we had Fitz and Bones, and we also had Lewis and Clark debuting in the same week. But this one, Lewis and Clark, the concept is a guy from New York City moves to Texas and buys a country music nightclub. So it's a fish out of water kind of thing, I guess.
I was going to say, how do you make a television show out of that?
Yeah. His name is Lewis, Stuart Lewis. And the guy that he works with at the club named Roscoe Clark. The reason the show is of any interest at all is that Lewis was Gabe Kaplan, as in Mr. Cotter from Welcome Back, Cotter.
Oh.
So this would have been, you know, a year or two after Welcome Back, Cotter ends. I just heard Gabe Kaplan a few weeks ago. He was a guest on Gilbert Gottfried's podcast. So that was fun.
That sounds like it would have been. Yeah.
Here's one that did not last long at all, but I actually remember this one. There's a sitcom called Open All Night, and it was about a 24-hour grocery store. It's just a guy and his family, and they run a 24-hour store, and thus open all night. And I remember this. It had this goofy theme song, but that's it. But I've got one more on the list, Cornflake, and it's a very favorite of mine, celebrating its 40th anniversary this year from 1981. And I think you like this show, too. So let's talk about The Greatest American Hero.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, let's. Because just the other day, I finally watched the full-length film that kicked off the entire show.
Yeah, Greatest American Hero started with a movie-length first episode, and I was putting together these notes to do a show about TV that debuted in 1981, and then out of nowhere, you texted me, you know, a turkey-themed text message, and said, hey, guess what? I just watched the first episode of Greatest American Hero. So on the one hand, I thought, great, because that's what we're going to talk about, and we hadn't even discussed it yet for this week's show, but then follow up, why did you happen to watch the first episode of Greatest American Hero this week, I wonder?
Kevin, that's an excellent question, and the best answer I can give you is I've just been meaning to get around to it, because we've talked about The Greatest American Hero a couple of times, and I was fascinated by the fact that any TV show, The Greatest American Hero included, started with a movie and then was a TV show from there. I didn't know that that was the way TV shows would sometimes get their starts back in the day.
That was very typical back then, in the 70s especially, and even into the 80s. That was very common, is they would make a TV movie that would serve as the pilot for a series. That happened a lot.
And I think part of the reason why I did it too was out of my deep respect for Joey Scarberry.
Yes, our undying love of Joey Scarberry, of course, singer of Believe It or Not, the Greatest American Hero theme song.
And also, in our prior talks about The Greatest American Hero, Robert Culp came up.
Yeah.
And I'm a huge fan from Combat Academy.
Robert Culp, he can be like a scary, tough guy, but also always very funny.
And some good heart in him, too.
Yeah, I mean, this was a show with a wacky premise, and they cast just the right people in it that it worked. And then William Catt as Ralph, as The Greatest American Hero, who, again, a guy that was around in movies through the 70s, one of the stars of Carrie. They were so great together. They made it work. And, like, it's hard to imagine that show working with anybody else in those parts.
I can't see it.
But especially Robert Culp, just so funny, so funny. Just always being exasperated and disgusted with everyone and everything. He's a tough guy and he's the FBI guy, and that he's so frequently not in control of what's happening. And suddenly he has to be a partners with a guy with superpowers. So you've got William Catt, you've got Ralph, who, yeah, is a teacher, high school teacher. Because that's as we've discussed, the other half of the show is it's like a goofy superhero action show, but it was also Welcome Back, Cotter. You know, speaking of Welcome Back, Cotter, with your Lewis and Clark star, Gabe Kaplan, half the show was Ralph with his classroom full of high school delinquents.
And Love Me, Rhonda.
Yeah, you've got Faye Grant as Rhonda, the girl. Michael Paré in sort of the Vinnie Barbarino, John Travolta role from Cotter. Now we've got Michael Paré doing this, who would go on to be, you know, Eddie from Eddie and the Cruisers and Streets of Fire. So it was like they were hedging their bets. Like, okay, we're going to do a superhero show, but we're also going to do a Welcome Back, Cotter teacher kind of thing at the same time. And it all kind of weirdly worked, sort of.
Yeah, I love especially when the high school kids show up to babysit while he has to go out and fight crime. It's rare that you see an entire crew of high schoolers show up to babysit one kid.
Yes, and from the beginning, it was such a weird dynamic with the students. He had this big, crazy class of goofy, angry kids, and the whole series kicks off in this pilot with, he takes them on a field trip. He just suddenly announces out of nowhere, guess what? We're going on a field trip.
And drives them out to the desert. And I don't know why.
Into the desert. Yeah. On a bus. And for how long? Because suddenly they cut to them driving in pitch darkness. Like, how do you take a group of high school kids out on zero notice?
Right. You know, their parents don't know where they are.
This was not a scheduled overnight trip or anything, and just suddenly it's 11 hours later. Like, what's going on?
I still don't fully understand why he took them to the desert.
I guess he just wanted them to look at rocks and lizards and stuff, I guess. Show them a skink or two.
Man, if I had to deal with those kids, I would have dumped them off in the desert and left them
Maybe
there.
Maybe that was his plan. Yeah, you know, I never thought of that. He was just going to ditch them out there. You're right. Yeah. But then the whole point of getting Ralph out in the desert in the darkness is that, you know, then the spaceship comes, drops off the superpowered suit. He loses the instructions and now he has superpowers, but he has to just crash around trying to fly, trying to figure out how to use them. So he's the awkward, bumbling, reluctant superhero paired up with the FBI guy. I love that scene, though. He's back home. He's a single dad, but the kid is watching Super Friends.
Yep.
And there were also several references to Superman, you know, to Ralph's girlfriend was saying she's like Lois Lane now. And there were two or three references like that. DC Comics actually sued The Greatest American Hero back then. They sued the producers saying that this was infringing on their rights to Superman. They went to court and lost. DC Comics lost. it was the whole thing was thrown out of court because apparently somebody looked at it and said, no, this isn't like Superman at all. Stop wasting our time, DC Comics. And then the other weird thing, really weird thing about the start of Greatest American Hero, William Catt, the star of the show, his character was Ralph Hinckley. The show debuted on March 18th, 1981.
Oh, the timing of this.
12 days later was the assassination attempt on Reagan.
Yep.
By John Hinckley. This show comes out, and can you imagine the poor producers saying, what is happening? It's
yeah, nothing you ever could have anticipated.
The show started less than 2 weeks ago, and now our character, our lead character, shares a name with a would-be presidential assassin. And so they scrambled to de-Hinckleyify the show. And like they had to dub over and they changed his name to Hanley, Ralph Hanley,
right,
for like the rest of that season. And then eventually, like season two, they switched back to Hinckley. They were like, all right, enough time has passed. He can be Ralph Hinckley again. But isn't that bizarre? And then also bizarre is that this pilot episode, part of the plot involves an assassination attempt on the president.
Right.
So how crazy is this whole thing?
It's ridiculous.
All part of the magic of The Greatest American Hero. And then we also have to mention Connie Selica, right? The third lead of this show. Connie Selica as Ralph's lawyer and girlfriend. And she was wonderful also, you know. And she starred in a bunch of stuff back then. She was in the sitcom Flying High in the late 70s as a stewardess. And then did Westworld. There was a Westworld TV series, which did not last long. And then finally got this one.
Oh, I loved her in this.
Yeah, as Pam on Greatest American Hero. I was coincidentally having a long conversation about Connie Selica with my friend Virginia just last night.
Really?
Yes. By complete coincidence, we were talking about Connie Selica. And she reminded me that at this time, Connie Selica was married to Gil Gerard, the star of Buck Rogers. And it freaked me out. I was deeply disturbed. It's going to take me a long time to get over that. But that's what happened. So yeah, Greatest American Hero. Super special, fun series. And I'm glad you finally just devoured the entire extra long pilot episode just this week by complete coincidence.
Completely worth it.
And anyway, there you go. What more do you want? That's what we had, Cornflake. That was new TV of 1981. That's what you got. Next week, of course, 1982. And we have a plan for next week.
That we do.
Because for 1982, it's time to go back to the backs of life.
Right on.
Our ongoing project for the year, of course. We're looking at every backdoor pilot episode of The Facts of Life. And we're up to the next backdoor pilot to look at from The Facts of Life is from 1982. And specifically, if you want to play along at home, next week we will be discussing Facts of Life Season 4, Episode 9. The title of the episode is The Big Fight.
Season 4, Episode 9, you say?
Season 4, Episode 9, The Big Fight. Is everybody jotting that down? So if you want to watch that sometime this week, go right ahead. If not, that's fine too. Watching the show, not a requirement. But I'm going to watch it, and you're going to watch it.
Absolutely, I wouldn't miss it.
And we shall discuss another Facts of Life backdoor pilot next week. Meanwhile, Cornflake, let's wrap up this show.
Perfect. I can help with that for sure. We're at flopcast.net. We're on facebook.com/flopcast. On Twitter, our handle is @flopcast. And on Instagram, the_flopcast. Wherever you listen to this podcast, Apple perhaps, find out where you can leave us a rating and or a review and do that. We would love that so much. Music for the Flopcast is written and performed by the Sponge Awareness Foundation.
Sponge Awareness Foundation, we have actually performed the theme to Greatest American Hero at least once or twice. Needless to say, it did not go well, but we did it. I think that's the only theme song on this entire list from today's show that we covered as a band. But my promise to you, Cornflake, next time we perform, the Sponge Awareness Foundation will perform the theme from Fits and Bones just for you.
Oh, yes, please.
That's why it's very important that we never perform ever again. Cornflake, thanks for joining me for this look at the TV of 1981. Thanks to all of you for suffering through our look at 40 years ago, how goofy everything was. And we shall march through the rest of the 80s over the next 8 weeks, because why not? Meanwhile, everybody be safe. Be good. Get vaccinated if you haven't yet. Come on, you know? And take care of yourselves. We're thinking of you. And of course, we'll see you here next week.
Peace and cookies.
Do you know how fast you were going?
Sorry, officer. One episode every 2 weeks?
2 weeks!
Did you also know you're carrying a dangerously heavy load?
Yes, sir, we do. We've got interviews, fight nights, film discussions, Desert Island DVDs, and lots more.
I think we've got to take you down to the station. You do not have to write anything, but it may harm the Cosmic Pizza Podcast if you do not mention, when questioned, something you later wanted in the promo or feedbacks. Anything you do say may be used in said feedback.
Cosmic Pizza Podcast is not about the cosmos, all about pizza.
Welcome to Dr. Geek's Laboratory.
Hello everyone, Dr. Geek here with a shout out to all the scientists who worked tirelessly to bring a COVID-19 vaccine into reality. And let's face it, creating something of this magnitude is a miracle worthy of Dr. McCoy himself. And now, Dr. Geek needs you to do your part. Remember, each shot is one small step back to normal, one giant leap to putting the pandemic behind us. We can do this. For more information, visit vaccines.gov to find your nearest provider.
Cornflake, welcome to the secret after show.
Hey, hey.
The real show was all TV talk, so I think we can sneak in some quick music of 1981 talk real quick, just for you secret people.
This seems like a solid plan.
So we're looking at the top 10 songs from this week, 40 years ago in 1981, and this is a killer list. This is a ridiculous list of classic early 80s pop songs. Number 10, Juice Newton, Queen of Hearts.
We do love our Juice Newton.
We've spoken of Juice so many times. We love Juice Newton. We love her hair, her crazy long wavy hair. It's just going to swallow us all up, I think, one of these days. We will all be part of Juice Newton's hair. Number 9 is Hearts by Marty Balin. I remember this. Marty Balin was from Jefferson Airplane / Jefferson Starship, one of those dudes. And this is like a yacht rock, sort of a hit single from Marty. Good song.
Cool.
Boy from New York City from the Manhattan Transfer. Remember that?
Yeah.
That was so goofy. That was so goofy. This is a acapella quartet, the Manhattan Transfer, got this out of nowhere, bizarre novelty hit song, which I liked back then. I was a fan as a little kid, and I don't think I could stand it anymore today.
I was just thinking that.
Yeah, that would be a tough sell for me today. Number 7, Kim Carnes, Betty Davis Eyes.
Now that is a song that has stood the test of time.
That was a monster hit song. You know I love the Pointer Sisters, and here they are at number 6, Slow Hand.
I was listening to this before we were recording today.
Really?
I forgot how great this song was.
Is that how you psych yourself up for the Flopcast every week? Part of your pre-show ritual is you play Slow Hand by the Pointer Sisters?
Well, yeah, now you know something about me you didn't know before.
This is arguably a rather naughty song, isn't it?
It's naughty, but it's also really well-produced song.
Oh, it's great. It's lovely. Yeah. But it's one of those things where, you know, all of America is just singing along to it everywhere. And it's like, well, wait a minute. What are they saying? This is all right. Number 5. All right. Forget everything I said about Manhattan Transfer being goofy and unlistenable.
Oh, boy. We're going further down the rabbit hole now.
Because now this is a problem. This is the Oak Ridge Boys, Elvira. Unlistenable, just dreadful, just an abomination, just something that never should have happened. This is our great national shame. It's the Oak Ridge Boys.
I have been subjected to bad karaoke versions of this more times than I can count.
Just wrong on every level. Number 4, Kenny Rogers, Could Not Be Stopped in the early 80s. And here's Kenny with I Don't Need You. But let's jump right ahead to number 3, Cornflake, because remember how we just spent a long time talking about the greatest American hero?
Yeah, we didn't plan this.
By coincidence, we pulled up this list and, oh, look, at number 3, there's Joey Scarberry with the theme from The Greatest American Hero, believe it or not. We love it. We never heard from Joey again. So let's move on to a group that we did hear from again and again and again. If you're like you and me, we never got over Air Supply.
No, we didn't.
And here's another record that I rushed out and bought at the time at number 2, Air Supply, The One That You Love. This is the song that they were performing when they touched you.
It is!
This is you and I went to see Air Supply a few years ago, and when they perform The One That You Love, they walk through the audience, and Russell Hitchcock reached out and touched your face.
Still haven't washed that cheek.
Yeah, so you have a special connection to this song. When he touched you, would you say that Russell had a slow hand?
Yeah.
Yeah, yes, he did.
He did have an easy touch.
He had a slow hand. He had an easy touch. He did not come and go in a heated rush. He was the one that you loved. Number 1, Cornflake.
Rick Springfield.
Rick Springfield, of course. Jesse's Girl. Now, Rick Springfield, like, this was his massive monster hit song of all time, of course. But again, this is a guy with a pile of hit songs. It's like, this is the one that everybody remembers. But you also know easily another half dozen hit songs if you heard them. But they're all dwarfed by Jesse's Girl, of course. And that was number 1 this week, 40 years ago, helping us all to try to forget the Oak Ridge Boys.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.